More. What's that supposed to mean? Me and my guys, with all this shit show going on, we've decided to promote ourselves. We're taking over. I sighed. Bedart's not going to like that either. Well, like I said, he doesn't get a vote. We've been putting up with his esoteric shit for long enough, and we think it's time for a change of regime. With you and George. He smiled some more and then assumed an expression of humility that did not suit him. You know, I racked my brain, and I honestly can't think of anybody better. Probably didn't take much racking. He nodded. Well, at least you get the honor of being my first official act. I watched as he raised the barrel of the M16 and centered it between my eyes. It's been nice knowing you, Sheriff. Jumping in spite of myself at the sound of the shot, I stood there without moving as seven more rang out and all of Culpepper's henchmen slumped to the ground, the loud ping of an M1C Garand clip being ejected just barely perceptible in the night air. Then, after a moment, of all things, the faraway spring mating call of the western meadowlark, the Wyoming state bird. Isidro, Epitaphio. Culpepper hadn't moved, but his eyes searched the periphery of his vision, and all of his men now lay on the ground, all of them headshots, all of them most certainly dead. Not sure to what lengths Culpepper's knowledge of vintage weapons ran, I figured it would take at least a couple of seconds for Isidro to recharge the unblocked clip, but I was willing to take the chance. If I were you, I wouldn't even twitch. Slowly stepping forward, I reached up with my free hand and took hold of the automatic rifle. Next, I reappropriated my hat, Colt 45, and Henry Standing Bear's Bowie knife. I think your men just got demoted. He still didn't move. Who in hell? You wouldn't believe me if I told you. I waved my hat toward the rock outcropping on the ridge, where I could see four individuals, including the one with a cotton poncho waving in the breeze, with his weapon aimed exclusively on us. I put my hat on, turned back to Culpepper, and stuffed my Colt in the pancake holster at the small of my back, along with the knife. Now, what am I going to do with you?
I've got a couple of suggestions.
I'm probably not going to like them. Without any warning, I brought the butt of the M16 stock around and walloped him with it. He landed on his back and lay there for a second, unmoving. Of course, his mouth was the first thing to recover.
Damn!
He raised his head a little, but then let it drop back.
I don't think I've ever been hit like that in my life.
Taking a step forward, I dropped the muzzle down in line with his chest, and I had to admit that I was impressed that he was conscious, let alone able to speak. You were right. They are making these stocks sturdier. He rubbed his jaw, surprised he was still attached, and slumped up on his elbows.
I guess you felt you owed me that one for hitting you?
No. That one was for Alexia, the housekeeper you abducted, the one whose nephew you killed, the one whose face you beat. He thought about it.
Oh, yeah.
I reached down and took the S&W 357 from his shoulder holster, and then poked his knee with the M16. Now, I'm not stupid enough to believe that you don't have a backup somewhere. He dropped his hand, and I could see where the left side of his jaw was swelling up like a softball.
Small on my back.
Roll over. You don't get to reach for it. He did as he was told, and I snatched a Glock 9mm and stuffed it in my jeans, letting him roll back and look up at me. His head must have cleared enough to give it a shot, and he kicked at the rifle with his foot, knocking it sideways, but I was able to get my free hand around his wrist before landing a knee and all 255 pounds into his solar plexus. His eyes bugged out and his ribcage attempted to not punch through his spine. I listened as the air rushed back into his lungs like a bellows, and he started coughing like he might bring up some solid organs. I raised a hand toward the ridge and stopped Guzman's sniper from scattering Culpepper's brains across the grass. Just for the record, I don't think I could be more pissed off at you than I am now. Re-aiming the M16, I asked again, "That's it?" He nodded, still coughing, as he lay there. "Other than your winning personality?" He glared up at me, not all of the fire completely gone. "I've got another question. Who killed Vic's brother, Michael, my son-in-law?"
"Not me."
I gestured with the barrel of the automatic weapon. "Who then?" I don't know. That was just Bidart's deal. I had nothing to do with that.
Pushing the muzzle closer, I pressed the point. But it was his deal.
All I know is I didn't have anything to do with it.
He never spoke about Michael Moretti in Philadelphia?
Not to me. He keeps his own counsel, Sheriff.
He tried to laugh, but with his damaged jaw couldn't.
Look, I'm not saying he doesn't have his dick in every dirty pie on the planet. All I'm saying is that it had nothing to do with me.
I considered what he'd just said, and he did a pretty good job of reading my mind.
What are you going to do, Sheriff? I mean, you're not going to kill me. It's not in your nature. We've established that.
I stared down at him and said nothing.
I mean, if you were going to kill me, you would have done it right after you hit me or when I made my play, something that you could have rationalized into a noble deed, but not like this. Not when I'm just lying here hurt and unarmed.
You mean like you were going to do to me? He massaged his jaw some more and then sat up.
Different. You're not a cold-blooded killer, Sheriff. Believe me, I know.
He smiled, and there was blood between his teeth.
I see the predicament. I mean, you've got to get out of here, but you don't want to kill me, so how about we make a deal?
How about I shoot you in the kneecap and just let your boss do my dirty work for me? His eyes widened just a bit.
Oh, come on now, Sheriff. We're just a couple of old cowboys here.
Try again. His eyes dropped, and I like to think that he honestly did think about what it was that he was asking. And for just a moment I thought I'd caught a glimpse of the man he'd been, or the man he should have become.
From one soldier to another?
He shook his head, and he sighed as his eyes came back up to mine.
All I want is a sporting chance.
He gestured toward the wall.
You're going to blow this place sky high? Give me 30 seconds on the other side of the wall before you throw that grenade. And either way, you'll never hear from me again.
My turn to think about it, as I used up time I didn't have.
I know I'm a piece of shit, but you're not.
I glanced back at the cliffs. Do you have any idea what that sulfur's going to do when it ignites? He chuckled a laugh that would have curdled milk.
Gotta be better than a bullet to the head.
Not necessarily. Running out of time, I stepped back. He smiled, and there was a lot of blood there now.
Thanks.
He slowly gathered himself and gingerly stood. You won't be thanking me here in a minute. He nodded and moved toward the wall, stumbling a little.
I'm surprisingly agile, even with 24 bruised ribs.
I watched as he hoisted himself onto the footing and then reached and took hold of the top, dragging himself up and straddling the wall as my conscience got the better of me, just as I knew it would. Come on back down on this side, and I'll let you go the other way, toward the monastery.
Now, a deal's a deal.
This time he laughed wholeheartedly.
I know me well enough to know that if you do that, I'll change my mind, get a gun, and come after you.
He looked down at the other side of the wall, no doubt at all the rotting bodies.
I deserve this, and who knows? Maybe I'll make it.
I said nothing but swung his rifle around, slinging it under my shoulder as I pulled out the grenade again. He stretched his jaw where I'd struck him, his face completely lopsided now.
30 seconds?
I'll give you 45.
How about them cowboys?
With the raising of a fist and a quick nod, he threw his other leg over the wall and was gone. Pulling my Illinois pocket watch from my dirty jeans, I noted the sweep hand of my grandfather's timepiece and counted the seconds as I placed the ring of the M67 in my teeth and pulled, still holding the lever in place as I reared back. Against all better judgment, I gave him 74, in honor of Bob Lilly. Chapter 13. Phlegethon. That was the only way to describe it. I'd heard my grandfather use the word, explaining that it was one of the five rivers of Hades. He had threatened numerous times to throw me in it if I wasn't accomplishing the ranch work up to his expectations.
I couldn't help but think of the old bird as I stood there, holding his pocket watch and seeing the inferno twisting its tendrils toward the sky. The air had left the environs with a sudden whoosh, and I'd thought the smoke from the grenade had blown back in my face, but the truth was that the oxygen surrounding the mountain had been consumed. Like spider webs of fire, the white-blue flames had shot through the slag heaps and covered everything like a moving tide. There was no explosion yet, but the channels of wind that the lack of air had created spun the fire in perfect funnels that danced up the cliffs as if the laws of nature and physics need not apply. Throwing myself backward, I could feel the heat from the conflagration and watched as the yellow powder burned between melting and boiling temperatures, changing its composition to a lower density but a higher viscosity and forming polymers, the molten sulfur assuming a dark red color, the entire mountain bleeding. There was no way Culpepper could have made it through all that. I figured it was time to hotfoot it out of there before the heavy poisonous gas poured over the wall or the mines exploded, sending tons of rock toppling down on me. I started running, but slowed to a jog with the effort, climbing after the mule train and hoping I could get enough distance between the cliffs and me. Making the first switchback, I stopped, wheezing for breath, with my hands on my knees, and wishing I'd kept running with Henry. I took a few deep breaths and turned to get a good look at the strangely illuminated mountainside. A small bank of what looked like ground fog was building on the upslope of the wall, and in minutes it would overrun the thing and begin seeping through the empty streets of the mountain town where I could see the 8 dead men lying on the grass. Blowing the pungent smell from my nose, I coughed and thought about what the poisonous gas would be like down there. Looking up at the cliffside of the numerous boreholes, I started thinking that I might have overestimated the effect of the trapped gas in the abandoned mines and that it was possible they were better ventilated than I'd thought. But it didn't really matter. The fire and subsequent gas would do the trick of shutting down Bidart's operation. From this perspective, I could see the taillights of the few remaining cars and trucks that were clogging the roadway, but I figured the occupants would make it to safety after moving the roadblock my friends had constructed. I silently thanked the powers that be that they and my daughter were far away. Winded from the exertion or from the fumes, I covered my nose and began climbing again, figuring that the sooner we all got going, the better. I'd just topped the ridge and was only 100 yards from my companions when I heard the first rumble. I turned in time to see one of the lower mines explode as if by 1,000 sticks of dynamite, sending rock shards and boulders cascading down the cliffs and against the wall. A credit to the builders, the structure held until 3 more of the holes blew out in a chain reaction of destructive power like a planned demolition. In a matter of seconds, the rest of the mines began exploding, and the entire cliffside slumped toward the town in a tide of burning stone. The wall didn't stand a chance against the millions of tons of fiery rock that pushed it aside and filled the streets, herding the deadly cloud of sulfur dioxide ahead of it like one of the 10 plagues of Egypt. The sail barn was destroyed, as were the majority of the buildings to the north of the town, and I noted that the old monastery took the brunt of the landslide and was collapsing onto itself, the rubble being pushed forward and down the hillside and toward the few abandoned cars that were left on the road. I'd never seen anything like it. There was a hand on my shoulder, and I turned to see Aiden. "God help anyone who are still there. We have to go." I followed him across the ridge, where Isidro stood with the garand hung over his shoulder. I stuck a hand out, and we shook. "Thank you." Returning the fingers to his mouth, he replicated the Western meadowlark. "Is you're welcome." I patted Isidro's shoulder, and we joined the others. Lowry shook his head. "You cowboys and Indians aren't supposed to work together."
"Watch us."
I passed him and walked toward Alexia, who was looking on from a safe distance, and spoke after catching my breath.
"How are you doing?"
She tried to smile, her face a mess. "You did not kill him?"
"Culpepper, no."
I glanced back at the collapsed and smoldering massif. "I think the mountain did it for me." Isidro, predictably, decided to walk, trusting that he could probably go safer and farther in his tired tread sandals than an hour broken-down mules. The rest of us were comfortably saddled, or as comfortably as we could be, and made our way in the darkness over the ridge, across the open meadows, and toward the drop-off that led to the sounds of the river that seethed below. The river twisted through the canyon like a rattler intent on biting itself, and in the moonlight I could make out the remains of a trestle bridge that the old-timers must have used to drive ore wagons across when mining the sulfur. I could see the flat rim of the canyon and the plateau that would take us back to Aiden's home, and hopefully a reunion with Katie, miles away. Isidro led on foot, and I pulled up the drags, glancing over the itchy spot between my shoulder blades every minute or so, wondering if Bidart had gotten away. Anybody who had returned to the monastery was most certainly dead. But he was an escape artist and had gotten out of dire situations before, like a black cat with nine lives. Thinking I'd seen something on the ridge, I pivoted in the saddle and studied the skyline. But after a few moments, figuring it was my imagination, I followed the others over the edge and down the treacherous track that was only as wide as a dining room table. It was moderately dark and the path was rough, but the mules were sure-footed and there were only a few slips as we got to a cornice that wrapped around the canyon wall. Personally, I was going to be happy when we had gotten far enough so that we wouldn't be sitting ducks from above. I unslung the M16 from my shoulder and wondered what exactly the mule I was sitting on would do at the sound of automatic gunfire. There wasn't a lot of room for mistakes on the narrow trail, and if one of them started to run, it was a surefire train wreck to the stony floor of the canyon a good quarter of a mile down. Past the cornice there was a wide enough overhang where the group had converged, Aiden circling back and waiting for me. "I think we made it."
"I'm glad you think so."
Urging his own mule a little forward, he looked back up the trail.
"Did you see something?"
"No, just a feeling."
"We have traveled too far, too quickly."
He reached down and patted his mount's withers. "And we have the only mode of transportation that can go this way other than walking."
"I hope you're right."
Nudging past, he joined the others as I caught up with Lowry, who, on the mule, looked to be the most uncomfortable person in the world.
"Hey, Sparky, I need a word."
He looked at me, puzzled. "What did you call me?"
"Sparky, it's an old term for radio operators."
"Radio?"
"It was a thing before your time. Anyway, the coordinates you gave the feds were for the village?"
"Yeah, why?"
I glanced around for effect. "I don't know if you've noticed, but we're not in the village anymore."
"So?"
"So how are they going to find us?"
"Oh."
Fumbling with my shirt pocket, I took out the sat phone and looked at the cracked screen. "Well, hell." Remembering the code that he told me, I punched it in and then dialed one of the only numbers I knew by heart. There was some buzzing and clicking, and then a familiar voice.
"Red Pony Bar and Grill and continual soiree."
"Henry." There was some fumbling, and I think for one of a half dozen times in his life, he was taken aback.
"Where are you?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you. How is Lola?"
"Perfectly safe. There were two men who came up on the res asking questions about you and your family a few days ago. Specifically about your granddaughter."
"And?"
"They disappeared."
There was a long and loaded pause.
"No one seems to know what happened to them."
He said nothing more.
"Thank you."
"Where is Katie?"
"Free and on her way back."
I adjusted the thing at my ear as the mules traipsed on. "Look, I'm in the middle of nowhere, Mexico, and I think I'm going to need some help before this is all over."
"What would you like me to do?"
"Contact Magruder's office in El Paso and tell them we've left the village and are heading west by northwest at a pretty slow pace, but that as soon as they can get here would be great."
"They know where this village is?"
"They have the coordinates."
"Consider it done."
There was a pause.
"Bidart?"
I held the phone there for a second.
"I'll talk to you when I get back."
Thumbing the button, I returned it to my shirt pocket.
Slapping my mule in the ass, I headed off after the group and then turned to look up, still seeing nothing but still feeling something.
After another 20 minutes, we made it to the canyon floor and a smooth pathway that circled back about a quarter mile between the boulders, leading to the dilapidated bridge. The river was narrow, only about 50 yards across, but the water was fast moving with rapids and whitewater a tainted brown. The bridge had evidently been built before the use of modern cars and was about the width of a Model T or A, which figured into the lifespan of the sulfur mines that had been in operation after the consolidation following the Mexican Revolution. The hand-formed stone and concrete abutments held rusted cables and deadheads that had likely been there since the 20s. There was plenty of room for a mule, but we would have to pick our way carefully over the broken planks. As Isidro stood on the bridge, as Aiden stopped his mount at the short incline.
I think maybe we should walk the mules. I've seen structures that have inspired more confidence, yes.
We all climbed off, and I went over to help Alexia dismount before turning to Aiden. Do you want to try it first, or do you want me to?
I weigh less than you.
Your mule doesn't.
I smiled, handing him my lead, and then began lessening my weight by unslinging the M16 and handing that to him as well, along with the .357 revolver and the Glock 9mm.
Jesus!
Culpepper. Pulling my own Colt from the small on my back, I handed it to him also. But this one is mine, so take especially good care of it. The boards of the bridge were warped, but rough cut to an exact thickness as they had been in the old days, so the four bars were actually a true 4 inches thick and stretched all the way across the 10-foot width. The ramp was on solid footings, but the span was supported by the cables and swung perilously. I could see the river rushing between the abutments after the first step I took onto the planks, but they didn't crack in two. I got brave and jumped up and down on the thing, but it didn't break. I was starting to get a little more confident, so I reached out and took hold of one of the guide wire strands that made up the makeshift railing. It came loose in my hand and dropped into the river, where it was swallowed and disappeared. The doc stood on the first plank.
I don't think we should rely on the railings,
I called back.
Agreed.
Walking a little farther out, I could see that the weather had done more damage near the center. There were a few planks missing, and the ones that were still there weren't likely to hold the weight of a mule, let alone a mule and rider. I stepped on one and watched as it split and hung there, one half on one side, one on the other. The next one seemed stable, but then there were two bad ones, and I was pretty sure that bringing the mules across this bridge was going to be an impossibility and a downright disaster. Turning back to Aiden, I shook my head and yelled,
"Not possible! Not on the mules!"
Carefully picking my way back, I figured we could make it walking. We'd have to let the mules go, climb the canyon trail on the other side, and then hike the distance to Aiden's place. The only one I was worried about was Alexia. But she was tough, and even after what she'd gone through, I figured she'd be okay. I'd almost made it back when my ears picked up a strange sound over the roar of the river. The sound bounced off the canyon wall, so it was difficult to tell which direction it was coming from, but I finally settled on the west and the rim from which we had just climbed down, the high-pitched whine of two-stroke motors. Studying the rim of the canyon headed back toward the mountain village I destroyed, I could see headlights playing over the top. Aiden followed my stare.
What is it?
Motorcycles. God, I hate motorcycles.
I watched as the driver who had taken out a pair of binoculars spotted us immediately.
Damn.
I gestured toward the others. Get off those mules, they're not going to make it, and we need to hurry. Moving to help Alexia, I threw a thumb toward the bridge. We need to get over to the other side before they get here. Lowry stared at the trail bikes, now congregating at the rim.
Then why?
I don't know, but I don't want to be here when they get here, do you?
In answer, he scrambled off his mule and immediately moved toward the bridge as I turned to Isidro, who already had unslung his M1. Following his gaze, I made a few calculations and figured it to be past the abilities of anybody.
Can you hit them from here?
He shook his head.
But when they get lower?
This time he nodded. I'll be back. Moving toward the bridge, I handed Alexia over to Aiden as he attempted to give me back the armory.
No, just the M16. What are you going to do?
Hold them off.
Once they get down here, you won't be able to make it up without getting shot.
If we don't slow them down, none of us will make it out of here. I gestured toward Isidro. Besides, I've got some pretty good help. I pushed his shoulder as he and Alexia started across, with Lowry leading the way. The mules, bless their hearts, stood there looking at me as I carefully pulled off the saddles and halters. Moving to the left, I herded them away from the bridge and then shooed them down the banks of the river toward the north, where they stopped.
Git, go on! Get out of here!
They moved a little farther and then found a grassy patch and began eating. Ah, well. I was sure they'd figure it out when the shooting started. Trying to think what our best position of advantage might be, I turned back to Isidro and glanced around at what I hoped was not our last stand. There were large boulders scattered across the canyon floor in a few spots, but what I was concerned with now was finding a path of retreat if that turned out to be necessary. Touching Isidro's shoulder, I drew his attention from the dirt bikes as they worked their way down the canyon wall a lot faster than we had. I'm thinking that we should get across the bridge now and set up behind the concrete abutments over there because that bridge is going to be a no-man's land when they get in range, and I don't know what kind of weapons they're carrying. He stared at me for a moment and then pointed to himself and then the ground where we stood. You want to make your stand here? He ignored me and looked back at the headlights of the oncoming motorcycles as they navigated the trail. Isidro, there's not enough cover, and if we have to retreat, they'll shoot us dead on the bridge. This time he pointed at me and then across the river. I shook my head. I'm not leaving you over here. He smiled and pointed toward the cliffs, flashing four fingers twice and then pointing toward his antique rifle and flashing the same number of fingers. You want to even the odds a little before we cross the bridge? He nodded his head once. All right, why not? I looked around again and picked out some pretty good-sized boulders and pointed toward them. Over there? He nodded, and we retreated, setting up on the other side of the rocks just to give us a little protection. Detaching the M16 magazine, I counted close to 30 rounds, which was good, at least with the limited range of the 5.56 by 45 millimeter NATO, I could lay down some suppression fire as the